Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it or just downloading it, listening to your iPod, you know, however you want to do it. Today we have an excellent show. We're talking about building an e-discovery process with John Rosenthal, who's head of electronic discovery at the Am Law 100 law firm Winston Strawn, based in Washington, D.C. My sense is one of the big words for 2010 and 11 for e-discovery will be process. The tools attorneys have access to now are much more sophisticated. Cases like Qualcomm and Pension Committee have made it clear that not having a well-thought-out process can have devastating consequences for both defendants and plaintiffs. And this is made especially true when you consider the various participants who need to be on the same page, on the same side of the case. Ever try to collect ESI without your client's support, or understand their IT infrastructure, or evaluate the record retention policies, whether they were followed? Then throw changing technology tools into the mix, which can mean forensics experts, data hosting service providers, backup tape recovery tools. Hiring reviewers who evaluate ESI for a case adds another set of eyes that need to be managed. And then how about third parties who might need to be subpoenaed to obtain ESI? In any event, managing an e-discovery project really shouldn't be done by the seat of your pants unless you have extremely comprehensive malpractice insurance. So today we dive into the world of e-discovery process. A little bit of background on John Rosenthal. He has an excellent background to discuss this topic. He was the architect of an e-discovery process at a different Am Law 100 law firm before leaving to join Winston Strawn to continue designing his vision of how e-discovery process should evolve. He's the chairman of Winston Strawn's e-discovery and electronic information practice group. He also lectures across the United States on issues of electronic discovery and record retention programs. John's also a participant in the Sedona Conference on best practices for electronic discovery and records management, and is on the advisory board member of the Georgetown University Law Center Continuing Legal Education eDiscovery Institute, and works with LexisNexis, Surety Inc., and Electronic Evidence Inc. In an advisory capacity. So, John, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks, Carl. Glad to be here.
And first of all, before we get complicated, tell us how you got into electronic discovery.
Well, I'm, believe it or not, one of the old guys in the business. About 15 years ago, one of our then Fortune 50 clients had what it perceived to be an e-discovery problem. And back then, almost nobody was doing e-discovery, and asked me to come in and try and help them design a response program. And at that point in time, there really wasn't anybody in the industry except maybe John Jessen and a few others. So I tried to self-teach myself, and by the time the federal rules movement started and Sedona started, I was in the right position.
Yeah, great. Before we jump into the sort of the framework of the questions, I thought of something when I read the list of everything that has to be done. John, you've got a great background. Can you do it by yourself?
I would like to think so, but it's not. You know, this is a collaborative process, and it requires teamwork. For a law firm, it requires teamwork between the litigation teams and the litigation support team and the e-discovery lawyers, if you have them. And on the client side, the teamwork has to be with not only the legal department, but the client's IT department and compliance, if the client has compliance.
Okay, well, let's start talking first a little bit about e-discovery process. What does that mean at a large law firm?
Well, different firms have different approaches to e-discovery, and some firms have an approach where they're going to essentially outsource most of their e-discovery and try and manage that outsourced process. And other firms, a handful of them, like Winston and Strawn, we're trying to be much more hands-on, where we're trying to own much of the e-discovery process, the EDRM model, in-house, and only use select vendors where appropriate. Now, I think, Carl, you already hit it on the nail on the head. E-discovery has three components. It has people, tools, and process. You have to identify the right people and educate them. Tools are very important, but today the tools are pretty sophisticated, and frankly, they're not that much difference. What is different is process. If you're at a firm like Winston & Strawn, we have 1,000 lawyers, 500 litigators spread across 6 domestic offices and then worldwide offices. We have, at any one time, 100 litigation teams working on different matters. If you let those teams approach e-discovery on an ad hoc basis, you're asking for trouble. And what you have to do is develop best practices through adopting processes, documenting those processes, educating on those processes. That way you ensure consistency, best practices, and things don't fall through the cracks. It also promotes efficiency, and it tremendously cuts costs.
You know, that's one of the big challenges firms face is getting that education out. We're going to be doing a show. I've got 3 lawyers lined up to talk about how they educate their colleagues internally on projects, because that's a battle that's very hard to win.
It's extremely hard to win. You know, for us, you know, in my our e-discovery and information management practice group, we have various subcommittees, and one of those subcommittees is marketing, and we have 2 marketing programs. We have an external marketing program to clients and prospective clients, but we actually have an internal marketing program that's designed just to promote, educate, and market services inside the firm. And my experience through talking to a lot of my colleagues that sit in the position I sit in as the e-discovery head of a large firm, that's a common problem and experience for everyone.
Now let's talk about the corporate clients and prospects. What does process mean to them in a best-case scenario, and since it's the real world, the worst-case scenario, and sometimes in the middle, too, I guess?
Well, you know, today I break the Fortune 500 out into 3 parts. You know, you have about a third that has already put in robust procedures and process around their e-discovery. You have a third of people that are trying to attack that now. And then you have a third that really, I say, is waiting to get hit on the head with a bedpan by that big, large case, in which, in that large case, they're going to end up paying probably 3 to 4 times what the cost of e-discovery should be in that case, because they haven't put process in place. And that means taking a look at a case from start to finish, from the legal hold through the collection, through the calling phase, through the review phase, through the production phase, and taking a look at your people. That means your internal people and your outside counsel and your vendors. Taking a look at your tool set, whether they be ones that you've purchased and put behind the corporate firewall, or ones that you are outsourcing or leasing, and then wrapping best practices around those processes. Let's take an average Fortune 100 client. You might have as much as 50 different law firms, and that's pretty conservative, 50 different law firms handling your litigation. And some of those law firms are going to be very good at e-discovery. Some of those law firms are going to be terrible at e-discovery. And you've really hired those firms for their substantive expertise within a particular area that they're litigating. And rather than relying on this ad hoc basis of whether or not your firm's going to do it the right way and how they're going to do it, I think the best thing for corporations are to design your own processes and then push them out to your law firms. That's going to ensure reasonableness in terms of sanctions if something falls through the cracks. It's going to ensure consistency, again, a sanctions issue, and most importantly, tremendous cost cutting.
And heck, it's your information. You know where it is. You can control it.
That's
you don't want the firemen to come in and handle it.
Absolutely right.
Well, there's been a lot of talk in e-discovery about cooperation, and I'm going to have you back next month to do a show with Bill Butterfield, who's on the plaintiff's side, so I'm sure that topic will come up there. Instead, I want to talk about another form of cooperation. And what does it mean to work with a team, quote, team, on the same side of a case and be on the same page? So let's talk through a project, okay? Let's say there's a trigger event. Clearly, you have to put a litigation hold in effect. How do you start the process with the eye towards eventually defending a case or the investigation? And, you know, what are the tools you might want to get your arms around a case?
Well, you know, one of the things that we do here at Winston & Strawn is go in and actually put in the processes and best practices for a company, and we've built these from ground up, and we've tested them now for on the order of 5-6 years. So yeah, these work. These processes I'm going to talk about for legal holds really apply to your medium and large size case. It does not apply to your slip and fall case. You can't necessarily do some of these things in your slip and fall type cases. But let's take a large case. The first thing I like to do is hold a retention plan meeting. That means it can be in person or by telephone, but I want outside counsel. I want your e-discovery lawyer if you have one. I want your relevant IT people, and it may be more than one IT person. You might need, for example, the person in charge of servers and the person in charge of the email system, or the person in charge of collaboration workspaces, depending on how big you are, an internal legal department representative. And what you're going to do in this meeting is you're going to map out a retention plan. You're literally going to sit there and whiteboard your potential areas of where potentially relevant data is stored and how you're going to go about preserving that data. And in 9 times out of 10, you know, for most what I call static data, stuff sitting on hard drives, stuff sitting on servers, you probably are not going to do anything more than issue a reasonable legal hold. But there is what I call non-static data, email, for example, IM, for example. If you look at an Exchange server in the morning and look at it in the evening, you're going to see the delta, the change in that server is dramatic, versus if you're looking at an NT file server where you're just storing Word or Office-type documents, the delta in the morning versus the evening or even over a month of that server is very negligible. People are adding but not deleting materials. So in your retention plan meeting, you may talk about doing some extraordinary preservation steps, such as taking some backup tapes offline, or making a snapshot, or making snapshots, or ex-merging certain portions of the that environment, such as key custodians' mailboxes. So there's a checklist, and you sit there and you start soup to nuts, go over the checklist, develop a retention plan, and then document your retention plan. You know, and talking to a lot of judges over the years, like Judge Shinlin, Judge Rosenthal, Judge Waxy, Judge Fagiola, transparency is important to the process. So what you want to do is write a privilege memorandum to the file of what you did in the retention plan meeting and what the agreed plan is. You want to write it privilege, but with the idea one day, if something falls through the cracks, in order to demonstrate reasonableness, you can choose to waive that or choose to produce it in camera. And then you go out and execute on your plan. And typically, execution, the first step would be to issue a legal hold notice. Now, the legal hold notice today is different than it was years ago. Years ago, the legal hold notice was, dear custodian, we've been sued by XYZ company. Please hold all relevant documents. I think the case law today is pretty clear that that kind of hold notice is not accurate or not sufficient, because it doesn't really provide the custodian with any real directions as to what to hold or how to hold it. So you have to have a pretty robust hold notice today, and especially in light of Judge Shinlin's recent opinion in pension committee, where she said the failure to issue a legal hold order constitutes gross negligence, issue the legal hold. And then you have to go back to the steps that the judge outlined in Zubelake in the process, which is you have to implement the legal hold. That means if there's something beyond issuing the legal hold, you have to do, like taking backup tapes outline or creating snapshots. And you have to make sure those are done. And then next is you have to follow up. Now, in the corporation, what does that mean? Judge Shinlin really didn't describe what follow up means. But best practices today in terms of process mean you have someone in the organization pick up the phone and call the custodian and say, did you get the legal hold? Do you understand the legal hold? Do you need help implementing the legal hold? So that's follow-up. And then a related topic that some people confuse is monitoring. monitoring is different than follow-up, and there hasn't been a lot written in the case law about this.
My next question. Go for it.
But monitoring, you know, follow-up means what I just said, follow-up. Did they get it, and do they understand the legal hold? Monitoring is very different. It actually means to monitor the legal hold. That means reissuing the legal hold after a reasonable period of time. And what I advocate is every 6 months. It means doing things like spot checking people's email accounts and data to make sure that they are actually implementing the legal hold appropriately. Making sure if you agreed to do certain things like taking backup tapes offline, that the backup tapes actually go offline. We've been involved in numerous instances, both defending and prosecuting, where everybody thought they had a reasonable retention plan in place and agreed, but in reality, somebody dropped the ball somewhere. Somebody forgot to extend the date on a archive. Somebody forgot to take tapes offline, those kinds of things. So, you know, in the legal hold process, that's what I think is best practices. And what I suggest and what we've done for corporations is we actually document that. We have a document we call Legal Hold Guidelines, in which we set this out in very specifics and with checklists and forms, and some of this is done electronically. Now, just another note, Carl, is that a lot of companies, a lot of vendors have now automated this process through various legal hold technologies. And those technologies are pretty good in terms of notice and tracking. And some of them actually also have the ability to index and hold documents. But you have to be careful because they often use the term hold in place, and most of them don't actually hold physically the documents in place. But you need to be careful about those programs if you're a corporation, and just don't take them off the shelf and roll them out. For example, many of them have forms in them, and I don't think some of the forms comply with some of the case law or best practices. So my advice to a corporation that's buying one of those legal hold automated software programs is that you really need to vet it and you need to customize it to your practices and to industry best practices. Anyway, Carl, that's my long-winded answer.
Well, that, you know, legal holds are where the problems oftentimes start, so it's good to be comprehensive. Can't recover from a bad legal hold very easily.
No, you really can, you know, and you can take some very aggressive positions later on about what you're going to produce or whether you're going to produce something, but you can't take that aggressive position if you haven't been bulletproof on preservation.
One small follow-up question. You know, it seems to me like that's a lot of operational background work. Who's the type of person that's staying on top of, you know, that process, dotting the I's, crossing the T's? Is that, you know, second chair type of a lawyer, partner, you know, paralegal? I mean, it sounds like a very detailed person, essentially.
Well, you know, on the law firm side, it varies depending on the kind of firm. You know, here we have 20 e-discovery lawyers and 20 litigation support specialists and project managers. And we try and train everybody across the board with the ability to do that retention plan meeting and do the follow-up. Because you might have a small case where you want to push it down to, you know, a project manager or an analyst, and you might have a massive antitrust case where it's a bet your company case and you want to make sure that partner's involved. So it's going to vary there. I think that, you know, you probably ought to at least have a core group inside your firm that you've trained to do this. And, you know, litigators, problem with litigators is they have big egos and they don't think they need help. This is an area where, you know, you do need some help and you need somebody that actually understands the area, both from a technological standpoint and legal standpoint. Internally, at corporations, my experience is also variance. Generally, you do not find the in-house lawyer actually doing the detail here. You generally find this pushed down to a legal assistant or case manager or if they have an e-discovery group, someone within the e-discovery group. And I don't think that's a bad thing. My only piece of advice there is that, you know, determining what documents to hold and not hold is really the practice of law. And even though the case manager or the legal assistant or the e-discovery director may help draft the legal hold and might implement the process, the lawyer who's ultimately responsible for the case really has to make that call and figure out what specific categories of documents need to be held and which custodians need to be held.
Okay, now you've got the litigation hold in place, and you've actually started collecting data to process it and review it. What processes do you think need to be in place for doing the processing?
You know, processing is what I call one of the dark arts. You know, over the last couple of years, it's gotten a lot easier because the software's gotten a lot better. But people use the term processing differently. And then also, as we have all these newer technologies coming online literally every day, some of the processing engines don't process, to use a pun, some of those documents very well. So it's very important that you know, when you're looking at the processing, you really understand what you or your vendor are doing, and you have a methodology in place to verify that whatever's gone into the processing engine actually got processed. And if it doesn't, a methodology for how you're going to deal with exceptions that don't make it into there. So let's back up. You know, you issue the legal hold, you need to physically go collect the documents. And hopefully you're doing that in a forensically sound manner. And again, you've wrapped written guidelines / process around how you're going to physically do that so that you have consistency in place and you make sure that you're collecting the document and its associated metadata and that you have a authentication or chain of custody so you know where you got it from and that it hasn't been changed or altered during the collection process. And then you want to deliver that to your vendor or if you're processing in-house. And again, you want to make sure you have a pristine copy put away in a vault somewhere before you actually load it up into the processing engine. And now get these processing engines today, Carl. You know this. You have.
Yes, we have them.
Well, you have them, but you know everybody's got. You know, some people are calling these early case assessment tools processing versus full processing. You know. You just need to be on the same wavelength with your vendor as to what they're doing. You know, a lot of these early case assessment tools, they're not full processing the document. All they're doing is creating an index and then allowing you to search against an index. That's really not full processing. Full processing means breaking it apart out of its container, deduping, denisting, creating the index, and then putting it in a format so it can be loaded in the LIT support system. Again, I go back here, because each vendor is different, because each tool is different, it's really a question of understanding what their process is, how the tool operates, and then mapping out, here's a step, here's this step, here's how we deal with exceptions, here's the ultimate load file we're getting, here's the format for the load file. And you know, I guess we're harping on a theme, but the theme has to be, you know, develop a written process, document it, and make sure you're somewhat transparent with it so that if you need to, again, if something falls through the cracks and in e-discovery it always does, you have the option to produce that information and show the court or the opposition that you were reasonable and not reckless.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I just had a knee-jerk reaction, so I'm going to have to say one thing. You know, when you mentioned processing tools that say that they are now early case assessment tools, my experience has been a lot of times that's because they're first in line. They're touching the data first. But just having a keyword search field, you know, to then try to form a sense of what your case is about. I did a podcast on concept searching, which is a more robust search tool. Separate topic. I actually was the guest on that show, but anyway, it's like you touched something. I had a knee-jerk reaction. I had to throw that out there.
Yeah, well, I don't think, you know, I think these early case assessment tools are good because it's a tremendous way to cut costs, but you have to really look at what your vendor or your software company is calling an early case assessment tool and understand how that can be used. Because if something has a concept or clustering engine on the front and that's what they're calling early case assessment, that's very different than somebody who's just generated an index and allowing you to search an index by one keyword.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, you got it. So, all right. Well, a couple small follow-up questions in this area. You talked a little bit about forensic experts. Not everyone uses forensic experts these days. Sometimes a client will collect the data. Sometimes that's less expensive. You know, the risk there. But you know, how do you approach that decision, and how do you manage it?
Well, let's just make sure we're on the same wavelength for those listening. There is defensible and then forensic. In e-discovery today, where the case law is, you have to collect everything in a manner that does not change the document or its associated metadata. I don't call that forensic today. I call that just defensible best practices. Now, with that said, there may be smaller cases where you could do the old drag and drop method, where you are going to, you know, the body of the document will be preserved, but you will change some of the metadata. I don't recommend that, but still we're seeing a lot of people do that today. And if you're going to do that, I just advocate, you know, go to the other side, tell them here's what you're going to do, and hopefully they will agree. Now, forensics, I define as something very different. That's where you're getting a certified, trained person that will use forensic tools to not only collect but to examine. So you might have a situation, say a theft of trade secrets case, where it's not necessarily that the document it's of itself that you're trying to find. It's you're trying to find that it sat on a particular computer or server at a point in time to demonstrate that it was taken from one place and moved to another place. And that's where you really need a forensic examiner. Now, for us, our project managers actually are certified and can do collections, but we do not do forensic work. And we don't do it for a couple reasons. One, because you need additional software. You need better. You need additional training. And the other thing is you need a witness. Often in forensic situations, you will need a witness to authenticate here's where they got the information, here's what they did to analyze it, here's what the results were. Now, the types of cases are not our typical e-discovery cases that you and I do, Carl. I would say 97% of the cases are traditional e-discovery cases where you're not using forensics. But there are that 3%, at least in my practice, and that would be criminal situations where a client's accused of a crime or a criminal investigation. It would be a theft of a trade secrets kind of situation, a quasi-criminal situation where you're trying to not just look at for the evidence but trying to establish where the evidence was at a point in time. And then the last area is a case in which a particular fact that occurred on a particular date is of great significance. So if there's an issue is when a contract was entered and whether it was entered, you may want to, for example, use forensics to examine drives to establish that fact. So that's kind of our demarcation line on forensics. And again, we're not doing a ton of that, but we still have that need. And the way what we do is we compile a list of forensic experts in different geographic locations, and then we make those experts available to our case teams where they can interview them and decide which ones they want to use. Because in forensics, at the end of the day, what's very important, not only are they qualified and capable, but are they a good witness?
Yeah, no, that's true. You know, the last area to sort of touch upon is occasionally you'll need to go to a third party to get information and issue a subpoena. How do you approach that process?
Well, you know, I handled a third party subpoena for a client a short time ago, and the cost of compliance to the third-party subpoena was $1 million. You know, e-discovery is very expensive. And as a general matter, even today, third parties are still expected to absorb the cost of being hit with a third-party subpoena. And some companies are in that business all the time, and they're very sensitive to it. I think it is a mistake in the e-discovery realm to just draft an onerous third-party subpoena and send it off. That was the traditional way in the paper dynamic. You sent it off, you got an objection letter from the other side, and then you had a negotiation. Here, under the rules, it specifically provides that you have an obligation to ease the burden on third parties. And it also affords the third party the right to make objections and move to quash or modify the subpoena if it's undue burdensome. My approach is be proactive. Before you issue the subpoena, call the third party, tell them what the case is about, tell them you need to get this evidence, and tell them, have a discussion about how you can draft the subpoena in advance to ease the burden. And I think if you do that, you're going to find the third party is a lot more cooperative. And frankly, rather than getting a boxcar, the equivalent of electronic boxcar discovery, where a third party is just dumping lots of data on you, you're actually going to get what you need as opposed to just a ton of useless data.
So it's almost taking the meet and confer process and saying, hey, this works between parties. Why don't we use this with third parties?
Absolutely. And the other thing is you have to be cognizant of cost. Judges, I think cost shifting is dead after Judge Shindlin's decision, except in two areas, three areas. I think it's cost shifting is still alive in the area of not reasonably accessible information. I think it's alive when a requesting party is being unreasonable. Judges have an attitude, well, I don't think you should get it, but if you want it and you're willing to pay for it, I'll give it to you. And the last area is I still find that judges are relatively sympathetic to third parties and they're willing to do cost shifting if you're being onerous to a third party. So one of the things you may want to have in that discussion early on is who pays or whether you're willing to contribute to any of the cost of compliance.
Okay, let's go into review now, because at some point you have to review the data. Does every case have a different review process, and how do you attack review?
I think it does. And let me start with the first caveat is I don't think in all cases you need to review the data. I think that's the old dynamic. You may not need to review all the data, or you may not need to review any of it. With Rule 502 now, you have the option of entering into a clawback agreement or a non-waiver agreement, making the information available for inspection. Generally, that's not something that we recommend, but we are seeing more and more of that, particularly in the small case dynamic. So that's just something to keep in mind. You don't always have to review the data. Now, to review the data, each case is different. So when we develop review guidelines, we try not to make them too stringent that they're not flexible enough that they can meet case needs from the small case versus the large case. But there are some general best practices in terms of the review. Now, the amount of data here is the enemy. We kind of like to break review apart into two phases. And the first phase is a phase where we're trying to further cull the data down and get to the core data. Why? Review attorneys today, even with the contract attorneys, that's still the overwhelming expense in a review. It's not the pure e-discovery costs. And a lot of law firms and a lot of review companies still make the mistake of throwing bodies at a ton of data And today, a lot of the game is, well, as opposed to throwing the, you know, $250 an hour associate or staff attorney at it, I'm going to throw it at the $50 domestic contract reviewer or the $25, you know, offshore reviewer. I still think that's the mistake. You know, when you look at a data set in your average case, about 20% is duplicates and about 25% is near duplicates. And a large majority of the data collected, because it's not surgically collected, is highly irrelevant. So think about two concentric balls or circles. You know, the old game was you collected over-collected data, and then inside there, or partially inside, was this very small ball of relevant data. And what you want to do in this first phase of discovery is shrink the amount of material subject to review. So really, the two circles are much closer together. So you're starting the review with a much smaller but highly relevant set of data. And how do you do that? You can do that through a wide variety of process. And again, a lot of the tools are similar here. You know, a lot of the tools now have, you know, near duping. They have concepting or clustering or Bayesian engines. They have email mapping tools. And what you want to do is use all those tools to cull out irrelevant data through various processes, and, you know, depending on the tool, we have different processes, but it's all documented to jump through these hoops with the idea of continuing to get irrelevant data out. And as you exclude data, you want to be able to sample that data to make sure that the data that you are excluding is irrelevant. And that's a process we work on, and we're able to cut down the amount of data we're looking at least 50 to 60%. That's before the first attorney touches that. How do we do that? We actually have an internal analytics team that does that, because my belief is that you can't train all of your litigators to really analyze data and develop search terms and those fun things. And what we're trying to do at the end of the day is using all these tools and get down to a really defensible set of Boolean searches, because I think that's what courts will sign off on and parties will sign off on. You're not going to be able to get your opposition to sign off on a clustering engine or a clustering result. So phase one, in my long-winded answer, Carl, is you put process in place using your tool set, but mainly process, by looking at custodians, date ranges, search terms, email maps, concepts, and get your data down and cut that down. Once it's down, the next step in the process, and again, here's where I think most people are falling down in today's best practices. When you look at most of the review firms and most of the law firms today, they're still doing linear review. They're treating all this electronic documents like you know, if it was 100 boxes of paper, they're still looking at it like 100 boxes of electronic paper, and they dole out the review to by box or by custodian to a reviewer and say, go through it. And to me, that process is far too time-consuming and expensive. We spent all the money to digitize this data, and we know from our experience that looking at like data, you get a much higher accuracy, consistency, and speed rate on your reviewers. So in our process, what we're doing is looking at the facts of the case and then determining how to batch out the data to the reviewers in like packages. So let's take email, for example. We like to thread all the emails at the beginning of the review and then batch them out by threads to the reviewers. That way, as opposed to, you know, if I've got a review with 20 different reviewers with different parts of that email chain all over the place, we know that chain is going to get marked for privilege and relevance different ways by the 20 different people. If I've threaded them all and I've got one person looking at them, we know we're going to be consistent, and we know that we're going to do it a lot quicker, which means saving money. And it's not just emails. You do it with all your data, and you can use Boolean searches to create these batches. You could use metadata, date ranges, You could do it by custodian. I'm not saying don't do it by custodian, but that's not always the best. Or if you've got a more sophisticated engine, you could press a button on and create your clusters or your concepts and bash it out that way. And so that's the second part of the process. And I go back to quality control and sampling. You always have to be looking at your results at a second level at some reasonable amount to make sure that, that what you're doing is accurate in terms of coding and tagging. And let me just add one thing in my long-winded answer. I'm not a fan of tagging and coding physically, other than responsive, non-responsive, responsive question mark, privilege question mark. I just think that when you do substantive tagging and go back and look at it a month later, it's highly inaccurate. And you can use the tool set inside your review tools, such as Boolean searches or concepts, to create that tagging, and it's going to be far more accurate and less expensive.
Yeah, no, that's true. Do you use any metrics to track performance in this area?
We do. On the review side, we're looking at speed rates. We're looking at hours worked. We're looking at time logged, and then we are spot checking for accuracy. So we're using all those metrics to kind of examine what's going on in the review.
Okay. One last area now, this is sort of, I think, looking into the future. Do you usually use software to manage workflow, or if not, is it Excel on a pad of paper? I mean, I guess there are different ways to manage it. You need some way to do it.
We, you know, I've been in this game for a while, and that's a huge issue that I've struggled with a lot. Because frankly, in my estimation, and I meet probably with 10 vendors a month to review their software packages, and then we've got a vendor committee here that does nothing but, you know, evaluate products and vendors. So we're pretty knowledgeable about the space, and the reality is that until recently there wasn't a project management software really designed for the e-discovery space. There are now about two or three of them, which are pretty good, and we acquired one of those this year, and we're in the middle of implementing it now. The reason why is that you know it's very difficult. Unless you're using an Excel spreadsheet or your Scratchpad to pull something up and say, well, this project's in this phase, here's the hour, here's the budget, here's the vendor we're using, that kind of thing. And some of these new software packages not only allow my management team to do it here, but on the software package we bought, it allows the case team to look into the case also and get that same picture. And we'll probably adapt it so the client has access to that information too. So I actually think that's kind of the next wave. I think you're going to see more and more of this software. Certain vendors have created dashboards so you could drill into their dashboard to see where they are in terms of your data. But for the law firm and the corporate side, we just have, I think, three or four options. But I think those options will build as we go forward.
And I think that almost leads us back to the first question. Can you do it by yourself? This is a collaborative project.
I cannot. I don't know anybody that can. You know, it's teamwork. It's teamwork with your client, and it's teamwork with your vendors. And, you know, because there's so many moving parts, you go back to this cliche of process. You know, Yogi Berra says, if you don't know where you're going, you're going to be lost when you get there. You know, that's true in everything in life, but it's particularly true in this e-discovery space. You've got to develop a reasonable process, document it, create checklists and forms, and that way you're ensuring consistency, you're cutting costs, and if something happens, not only can you recreate what happened, but you can demonstrate to a court that you were not reckless, you were reasonable, and that if you're going to be sanctioned, the sanction should be on the lower side, not on the higher side.
Last question. Any tips? We sometimes get this. People, we've listened to these shows. We're going to try this for the first time. Any tips for someone to try to start their case on the right foot with a process if they haven't done it before?
Hire me. No, I'm just.
That was a loaded question.
I work with Sedona and Georgetown. We've published a lot of good best practices pieces that already develop some of these processes out there. Some of the vendors have materials on their websites, and some of the blogs have materials on the websites, and you can get checklists and some of these things. I, in the past, am happy to share, you know, some of this with people up to a point, and after a point, it's a retention. But, you know, I don't think there's a necessity to recreate this from start. There are a lot of people, myself, you, others, that have been doing this for a while, and you can really leverage that information. So reach out for help, either it be through, you know, organizations like Sedona or Georgetown eDiscovery Institute, or through some of the other established people that have been doing this for a while.
Okay. Well, we've reached the end of the show. John, thanks for joining us. Looking forward to your next show with us and Bill Butterfield, where you can both debate the importance of metadata, which should be very interesting. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com, esibytes.com, for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of Information. And however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.